Welcome to this second episode in Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. This series explores the extremes of human existence. Some of the themes in these stories will be challenging, and listener discretion is advised. If you are suffering from a mental health condition and find yourself in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything. It is a quality of being human to test our endurance and measure our greatness. From runners chasing times to climbers conquering peaks, there are countless ways that endurance may be measured. But some forms of endurance cannot be so quantified. How do you measure an individual's strength of will or instinct for survival? Some tests of endurance can only be qualified through the telling of their story. This is the story of Julianne Koepka. Julianne was just 17 years old when she and her mother arrived in Lima Airport in December 1971. In the preceding days, a flurry of storms had caused widespread flight cancellations. As the weather then calmed, Lima Airport descended into chaos, as airlines hurried to make up lost flights, while passengers prayed that they'd be back home for their holidays. While patiently waiting, Julianne idly wonders whether she'll get to see her father at Christmas. But then an announcement on the tannoy silences the crowd and her thoughts along with it. Finally, she and her mother are called to their flight. They fight through a surge of other anxious passengers and make their way towards the boarding gates. As they approach their plane, Julianne and her mother marvel at the size and elegance of the formidable Lockheed Electra, the plane they are grateful to be finally boarding. Little do they know that even in the 70s, it is a dated plane. The design of the wings as they insert into the fuselage prevent it from adequately resisting turbulence. It is a plane that has already been deemed out of service in the United States. But on Christmas Eve, 1971, it is the plane that Julianne was destined to board. She and her mother seat themselves in the penultimate row. Julianne is sat on the window seat, allowing her to admire the bright morning sunlight. Her mother sits beside her, while a heavy-set man drops himself into the aisle seat and promptly falls asleep. Her mother is not an easy flyer. As an ornithologist, she has spent her life dedicated to the study of birds, and as such has a unique perspective on the principles of flight. As she was inclined to say, "It's totally unnatural that such a bird made of metal takes off into the air." Julianne does her best to reassure her fretful mother. Their flight from Lima traverses swathes of magnificent Peruvian rainforest and should only take about an hour for them to land in Pucallpa. The mood of the other passengers helps to soothe her mother's nerves. The man sat beside her breathes away heavily in a peaceful sleep, while elsewhere the atmosphere is full of festive spirit, with scattered happy families excited at the imminent prospect of Christmas. The flight crew bring them a sandwich and a drink. 10 minutes later, beaming stewardesses shuffle back along the aisles to clear away their breakfasts. They have been flying for 30 minutes, about halfway through their journey, when the plane shudders awkwardly, and the cheerful passengers are reminded of where they are. A creeping unease swells up amongst them, but the rise is not sustained, and their murmurings of chatter are gradually resumed. The plane shudders once again, more violently than before, and an insidious shadow passes overhead. The generous sunlight illuminating the windows weakens to a flicker before a blanket of darkness covers up the light. An unnatural night descends upon the passengers. The sky turns black, and the spell of content is soundly broken. The sudden roar of the engines is matched by the restless rattling of the plane, while the troubled passengers are silenced into their seats. Julianne's mother looks over, saying, "Hopefully, this goes all right." Her palpable fear outshines her attempt to reassure her daughter. Julianne smiles, but she does not respond. She stares straight ahead, fixed within her seat. The darkness is shattered by the onset of lightning. Once started, it is ceaseless, wildly flashing from every direction. The shaking of the plane rises to a crescendo, while the overhead compartments respond in loud chorus. As one, they fly open, unleashing an array of objects onto the passengers. Their resilience is broken, and they cry out in fear, as Christmas gifts pimble freely around them. From Julianne's position at the rear right of the plane, she witnesses a sudden explosion of light, which shines out powerfully from the plane's right wing. Whether triggered by lightning or a malfunction of the engine, she could not possibly know, but her sense of time is impossibly slowed. She hears her mother speak in startling clarity, somehow rising above the roar of the noise. She turns to her daughter, saying quite calmly, "Now it's all over." The unbearable shuddering is jolted into submission. The terrifying stillness subdues the plane, while its passengers are tortured by a lengthening pause, an excruciating silence that portends something terrible. Quite slowly at first, the plane's nose leans over, but it accelerates downwards, dragging down the plane into a screaming descent. Julianne looks on with terrible helplessness as the aisles flip down into a vertical position. The laws of physics are twisted and broken. The shifting pull of gravity suspends objects in the air. A moment passes by, and Julianne's world is transformed once again. The shrieking engines, the frenzied hysteria, all of it is silenced. Suddenly there is nothing but the sound of rushing wind. Julianne sits alone, but no longer in the plane. The structure of the plane has succumbed to the storm, and it shatters as the lightning tears it into pieces. At an altitude of 2 miles, Julianne is overwhelmed by a feeling of solitude, but greater than that is the sensation of falling. Julianne gazes down at the sprawling jungle stretching out beneath her, an incomparable expanse of untouched rainforest. But it is rising to meet her, and every instinct in her screams in objection at the danger rushing towards her. But its accelerating ascent surges inexorably. Its speed overtakes the rise of her fear. Her mind is overcome. Her consciousness wavers, and then there is nothing. She tentatively wakes into a semblance of a dream. In it, she takes a grip on her waking mind before making the decision to return to reality. Mud soaks through her clothes, coating her skin, but her fragile consciousness feels herself breathing, and she knows she is still living. She stays in this position for a day and a night. Her left eye is badly bruised and swollen shut, but her right eye begins to open unsurely. It stares at the beams of golden light that slant down through the leaves of towering trees. Her mind creeps awake, and she sees herself clearly. The urgency of her predicament sharpens her mind. Somehow, she has survived a catastrophic plane crash, and she finds herself alone in the middle of the jungle. Julianne tries standing, but she lacks the strength, and her tentative efforts quickly exhaust her. Thoughts of her mother surface in her mind. She glances to her left, where her mother had been sat. The seat is gone. So is the seat of the heavyset man, who was seated to her left. The faint tick of her watch distracts her thoughts. She examines its face. The watch is still working. It is 9 o'clock in the morning. She tries her legs again, but they will not lift her weight. If her legs do not work, then Julianne knows that she must die. She rallies herself, and through pure strength of will, she manages to bring herself up to her knees. Everything goes black, but she catches her consciousness before it gives out on her again. She drops her weight down and stays there for a while, feeling the gradual return of her strength. While lying on the ground, she sends out a mental probe through her body to explore the extent of the inevitable injuries. There is a throb from her shoulder, and she reaches for her collarbone. It is crooked to the touch and obviously broken. She sends out another probe. There is a throb from her leg. She reaches down to her calf. There, she sees a gash in the muscle, a deep, jagged wound that has punched through the skin. It is curiously painless and not obviously bleeding. She sends out a third probe, but it cannot detect any other major injury. Instead, it stumbles upon something else entirely. It is something similar to pain, but closer to fear. It is the frightful sensation of being alone. Julianne hauls herself to her feet before the noise of the jungle hits her full force. There is the perpetual sound of scurrying and rustling, clicking and buzzing. The dense canopy above her filters the sunlight, sending an eerie green glow to the ground. The shifting mosaic casts flickering shadows. Above, she discerns a cloudless sky, but despite the lack of rain, there is a billowing shroud of cloying moisture. It forms a haze in the air and clings to her skin. For no reason in particular, Julianne is struck by a longing for her parents. Both spent their careers in the field of zoology. They were driven academics with insatiable curiosity. Their enduring quest for knowledge meant Julianne was unusually familiar with her present surroundings. 3 years earlier, when she was just 14, she and her parents relocated from Lima to the Amazon rainforest. There they established the Panguana, a research station set in the middle of the Amazon. Julianne learned to fish, forage and hunt. From July 1968 to March 1970, Julianne was known as the Jungle Girl. The pleasant memories melt back into the present. Her inhospitable surroundings remind her of her lessons and strengthen her resolve. Trembling legs lift her from the ground and finally find the strength to support her weight. She steadies herself and examines her surroundings. With a great breath of air, she fills up her lungs and shouts out for help. But if the jungle hears her, it does not return an answer. Looking at the ground, Julianne realizes that one foot is bare and the other is still wearing a muddied white sandal. The prospect of setting out unbalanced in this way caused her to consider discarding it at once. But there are snakes in this jungle. She keeps the sandal on. Uneven protection is better than none. The thought of her sandal moves her mind on. She scrutinizes her sleeveless patchwork mini-dress. The zipper on the back is partially broken. While feeling around, she finds another wound in the muscle of her upper arm. She wonders how she missed it. It is smaller than her calf wound, but it is several inches deep. While standing up tall, she checks herself carefully for any other injuries, but before she is finished, she realizes her thirst. A powerful thirst rises quickly to the top of her list of priorities. The low-lying leaves glisten with drops of sparkling water. She moves quickly amongst them, sucking up the fluid and feeling it nourish her. On her previous forays into uncharted jungle, she would never go anywhere without taking a machete. Not only did this allow her to hack through the foliage, it also allowed her to mark the trees as she went, to serve as a reminder of where she had been. Julianne knew the value of orientation. To be lost in the jungle meant a certain death. In the absence of a machete, she took mental photos of memorable trees before cautiously mapping out a direction amongst them. At the beginning of her search, she finds nothing to suggest a plane fell here from the sky. There's no wreckage and no people. But soon she stumbles upon a bag of sweets and a dirty piece of bread. The bread is soaked with mud and softened by the moisture. She eats what she can and keeps the sweets saved for later. Her search carries on and she calls out intermittently, in widening circles surrounding her crash site. But her continuing efforts yield nothing else. But then something distracts her. A synthetic sound breaks through the natural noise of the jungle. It is the hum of an engine. That means only one thing. A plane flies above her. The jungle canopy blankets the sky, and her fevered agitations do nothing to penetrate it. The sound doesn't last, and the engine departs. Julianne is left, frustrated and alone. Her feelings of hopelessness are soon undermined by Julianne's demanding sense of purpose. She stops briefly to meditate and consider her position before another sound serves to distract her attention. It triggers a feeling of hopeful familiarity. It is a sound that has been with her from the beginning of her ordeal, carefully camouflaged amongst the incessant jungle noise. But her perceptive mind sees the shape of the sound, and it slowly infiltrates her sense of consciousness. It is the barely perceptible sound of tinkling, the sound that signifies the passage of water. Immediately, she focuses her mind upon the sound, clarifying its presence and triangulating its origin. Her patient and systematic detection works, and she comes across a spring, which feeds into a stream. The significance of this find is not lost on Julianne. Not only does this provide her with a source of hydration, but it also gives her a sense of direction. Springs ooze through the soil to form channels and rivulets, which given enough mass will form a steady stream. If the stream is sustained, it will join up with others, coalescing until ultimately it grows into a river. The voice of her father is heard in her mind. If you get lost in the jungle and you find flowing water, stay close by and follow its course. It will bring you to people. To Julianne, the prospect of a river suggested civilization. That flicker of hope was her chance for survival. After quenching her thirst and washing her wounds, Julianne resolved an important decision. By now she was sure that if there were other survivors, she was unlikely to find them. If she wanted to live, she must abandon hope of finding her mother. She must follow the water and pray it led to safety. The trickling stream proves difficult to follow, intermittently vanishing amongst dense vegetation. But Julianne is persistent, and the impulsive rivulet always reappears. As she follows along its course, it grows steadily wider, forming a bed with a 20-inch wide channel. By 6 in the afternoon, it begins to grow dark, and Julianne looks along the stream bed for somewhere to shelter. Her father had taught her to make fire by rubbing sticks or smashing stones, but everything is soaked, and so she settles for a spot that is protected at the back. Darkness sets in, and if there is any moonlight, it does not reach the forest floor. Her body is beset by the various insects, but her mind is past caring, and she collapses into a deep and dreamless sleep. It is the 26th of December, 1971. Morning breaks and Julianne wakes. Perhaps it is the lasting concussion, but she feels no fear and no pain. She wakes feeling rested and empowered with a sense of renewed determination. She eats a ration of her sweets before getting to her feet. The stream meanders tirelessly through the jungle, hauling Julianne around the many fallen trunks. Its mischievous course costs her precious time and strength, vital commodities she could not afford to waste. But Julianne is determined, realizing the cost of succumbing to temptation and shortcutting through its turns. Should she wander too far and lose earshot of the stream, the jungle's infinite, ever-shifting patterns would do nothing to help her recover her path. The risk of being lost is simply too great. The terrain is unpredictable, occasionally forming hills that rise up fiercely to imposing heights of over 100 feet. But the indifferent stream always finds a way, detecting the subtlest downward slopes, and Julianne in her diligence does not fail to follow. After hours spent shadowing its tenuous course, the stream grows increasingly rocky and wide. Soon she is wading through it, right up to her knees. Her first step is always with her sandaled foot. The other follows in its path, painfully aware of its own liability. Then lurking at the edge of her peripheral vision, an indistinct shape sends a stab of fear that halts her in her tracks. At the edge of the stream, a monstrous bird-eating spider crouches aggressively in a threatening pose. Each eyes the other warily, but Julianne carries on, watching the arachnid until it vanishes from her sight. Julianne's journey carries on through the day, which is only disturbed by the tortuous sound of a plane overhead. If there is a rescue operation, perhaps others have survived. Maybe even her mother. She clings to the thought, and the hope gives her strength. Unbeknownst to Julianne, news of the plane crash has mobilized an enormous rescue operation. Numerous leads spontaneously erupt from the local populations, but most of them are wild and patently false, costing the rescuers time and resources. Not so far away in that Peruvian jungle, American missionaries have been studying the language of indigenous tribal populations in the hope that they might bring them the word of their God. After hearing of the crash, they pool their resources with the Peruvian Air Force, who have already begun mobilizing their airborne fleet. But despite all their efforts, their search is in vain. All trace of the crash seems swallowed by the jungle. The continuing false reports frustrate their efforts, causing the commander of the Peruvian Air Force to dictate that if any person is found to raise an alarm, they will be arrested and interrogated, regardless of the truth. His intention is effective. There are no other reported sightings. On her third day in the jungle, Julianne stumbles upon an object in the stream. It is a charred piece of the plane's engine, the first piece of wreckage she has seen since she started. On the fourth day of her trek, Julianne hears something that triggers significance. It is the flapping of large wings. The sound is unmistakable. They are louder and last longer than any other bird. With creeping realization, Julianne is subdued by a mounting sense of dread, because if vultures are nearby, so will be their carrion. As the stream guides her around a bend in its course, she sees a 3-seater bench rooted into the ground. Still strapped into their seats are the rotting bodies of 2 men and a woman. Their heads and chests are buried in the earth, while their legs stand erect, pointing grotesquely up to the sky. Julianne stares in horror, while 2 lurking vultures wait patiently in the trees. Her panicked thoughts turn to her mother, but a glance at the corpses quickly dismisses them. She checks through the scattered metal for anything of value, before the sound of search planes rumble overhead. She knows she must hurry. Her time is running out. The days march by with endless repetition. She walks through the day, driven by a cocktail of determination and fear, until twilight falls and she searches for shelter. Fitfully settling into a semblance of sleep, her nights are tormented by the plagues of insects and thoughts of her mother. Her nights become nightmares. The endless blackness is both disorientating and frightening, and the onset of rain soaks her to her skin. If she happens upon sleep, she is soon to be woken by the buzzing and scuttling of a million insects, which hover and crawl, biting and stinging. The more daring amongst them take any opportunity to infiltrate her ears, her mouth, and her nose. The mornings relieve her, but with each day that passes, Julianne grows weaker. The days blend seamlessly into the next, and soon Julianne has eaten up all of her candy. As it's the rainy season, there's barely any fruit. With no knife, she's unable to hack out the palm hearts from the stems, nor can she fish or cook roots to eat. On the fifth or sixth day, Julianne hears a bird call that triggers new meaning. It is the distinctive sound of houtzins, a species of bird that exclusively nests near the open stretches of water. She follows the bird calls and soon finds herself at the end of her stream and the beginning of a river over 30 feet wide. In that bright open space, the yawning sky spreads magnificently above her. The rush of the water fills all sense of sound, but right on cue appears a plane in the sky. Unlike the previous distant rumblings of planes, to Julianne this sighting is both vivid and real. She waves and shouts as furiously as she can, and suddenly she is filled with determined belief, which rallies in the face of her growing exhaustion. But as she watches the plane turn and fly out of sight, the strength of her hope transforms into anger. It swells up furiously, surprising herself at the intensity of her feeling. Then it dwindles and weakens, soon giving way to despair. After so many days, she has reached an open space and sights a rescue plane, but instead of being saved, it ignores her entirely. The words of her father resonate in her ears. She pulls herself together and focuses her mind. The vegetation is too dense to hike along the riverbank, so she finds herself a stick to help her through the shallows. She knows that these rivers will be infested with stingrays, and so as well as to steady her, the stick proves useful in scouting out her steps. For if you step on a stingray, it reacts by stabbing you with a poisonous stinger, infecting the wound, causing swelling and fever. It may not be fatal, but the inevitable prospect of dirtying the wound in the riverbank's mud would likely lead to poisoning of the blood. Julianne takes every step with meticulous care, but her care takes time. And her time is running out. Her progress is slow, and as the day marches on, she knows it's not enough. She is running on fumes. The only driving force is her will to survive. To preserve her precious energy, she decides to swim through the middle of the river. While her progress is quicker and protects her from the stingrays, this choice exposes her to piranhas and caimans. As she floats along the river, she sees martens, brocket deer, and howler monkeys. Julianne is disappointed that their attention is so brazen, their curiosity so bold. The implication is clear. No animals in these parts have come across people. She buries the thought and paddles onward through the water. As the sun descends, Julianne searches for shelter along the riverbank. She seeks out places with protection at its back, in the hollow beneath the tree or in the space inside a bush. While there is still enough light, she nurses her wounds, examining and cleaning them. The wound in her calf is swollen and white, but thankfully quite painless. It is the wound in her arm that causes her concern. The sight of it alone is enough to make her recoil from herself. writhing maggots peek out of the wound. Somewhere along the way, flies have laid their eggs, and hidden beneath the skin, the maggots hatched and burrowed deeper into the flesh. But they burrow with purpose, carefully avoiding blood vessels so that the wound doesn't bleed. Julianne knew that it would soon fester and swell up painfully. They had to come out. Using the buckle of her now broken watch, she uses it to dig the maggots out of her wound. But as soon as she approaches, they vanish into her flesh. As she watches the fat maggots slip away beneath her skin, an unsettling thought strikes her. They are devouring her from within. There is little solace gained from reminding herself that any good parasite will generally avoid harming its host. When she wakes the next morning, Julianne feels a new pain in her back. She reaches around. It feels sticky and tender. She withdraws her hand. It is covered in blood. While swimming in the river, the scorching sun has caused second-degree burns across her back and her legs. It changes nothing. She carries on as before. Julianne is growing weaker, and she increasingly needs breaks to rally her strength and prevent herself from drowning. On one occasion, while resting in a sandbank, she hears a squawk that she has not before heard. She opens her eyes. Scattered around her are a jostling troop of baby caimans, each one measuring about 8 inches in length. Her immediate thought freezes her to the spot. Where is the mother? Fixed where she lays, she frantically surveys the ground all around her. If the mother sees her first, Julianne knows that she will be attacked. They simultaneously lock eyes. The caiman is fueled by its instinctive response, and it rises from the undergrowth, its opening jaw revealing rows of vicious teeth. As it advances upon her, Julianne rolls away, slipping back into the river, away from the caiman and its litter of children. By the 10th day, Julianne is drifting weakly through the water. Her path is full of logs, and she expends precious energy, avoiding collisions. Her requirement for breaks is rising with frequency. She drops her body onto a quiet gravel bank, where she dozes for a while. When she opens her eyes, they settle upon something that doesn't belong. There on the riverbank, not far from where she lays, is a boat. She finds herself drawn irresistibly towards it, paddling through the water without looking away. It is only with its touch that she truly believes it is not a hallucination. A beaten trail rises up from the riverbank, and she recognizes the unmistakable outline of footsteps in the mud. It takes several hours for her to cover the few yards, but she drags herself along until she comes upon a shelter. A palm leaf roof held up with poles, and a floor made of the bark of the pona palm. In the shelter she sees the boat's outboard motor, and next to it a barrel of gasoline. Her maggot-infested wound is throbbing unbearably, but the sight of the barrel gives Julianne an idea. She screws off the barrel's cap and pokes down a hose. Sucking up the gasoline, she then drips it into the wound. The throb from her wound rises up into agony as the fleeing maggots dig deeper into her flesh. In spite of the pain, she drops down yet more until finally the maggots rise to the surface. She counts 30 thrashing maggots as they escape the open wound. She scrapes them away and briefly glows with a surge of relief that outweighs her raw pain. Night is drawing in. Still no one has come. Julianne wraps herself in a tarp she finds in the hut and lays down upon the sand, collapsing into sleep. Morning comes, and with it an unwelcome dilemma. Does she stay where she is, continue on foot, or make use of the boat and take it downriver? Julianne realizes that the limits of her strength are close to being met. and manoeuvring a boat would be impossible as well as dangerous. It also crosses her mind that the boat might belong to a trapper or woodcutter out working in the jungle, and to take the boat from them would endanger their lives too. She continues to reflect indecisively on what to do. Midday comes and goes, and she has lost time and energy. Part of her screams that she must keep on moving, but her wounded, frail, and malnourished body is simply unable to take her any further. She lays sprawled in the sand while despair sets in. Julianne is dying. When she starts to hear voices, her mind meanders on the edge of her consciousness, and she believes the noises to be a product of some cruel waking dream. But the voices are both rising and converging on her position. Three lean men come striding from the forest. As they emerge into the clearing, they immediately catch sight of her, stopping in their tracks and recoiling in fright. They stare at her in astonishment. Julianne's mouth opens, and she says to the men, "I'm the girl from the crash. My name is Julianne." Beltran Paredes, Carlos Vasquez, and Nesta Amasafuen are the names of the forest workers who happen to find Julianne in their camp. They feed her farina, a mixture of roasted and grated manioc, water, and sugar. As generous as they are, Julianne struggles to keep any of it down. They bring her water and nurse the wound in her arm, which spills out yet more of the gluttonous maggots. They explain to Julianne that as far as they know, she is the only survivor from the crash. With this knowledge, she realizes her mother's fate is now sealed. The following morning, they carry Julianne to the boat, where they lay her down gently and cover her with a tarp. Their journey takes them to the mouth of the Chaboña, where it flows into the Pachitea. There on the riverbank lies the village of Turnavista. When the villagers see her, they turn away in horror and whisper urgent prayers. Unbeknownst to Julianne, the blood vessels around her eyes have burst from a combination of trauma and malnutrition. The blood has seeped through the whites of her eyes, even opacifying the circle of her irises. All that is left is the black dots of her pupils, engulfed by the surrounding hellish red. Her alien complexion is both confusing and frightening to the God-fearing villagers, but the woodsmen reassure them. They find Julianne soup to eat and a nurse to assess her. The nurse dresses her wounds and gives her injections of tetanus and penicillin. Not long later, Julianne is taken to Yurinacocha, where a doctor provides her with more medical attention. He removes yet more of the maggot infestation, which have further colonized the wound on her leg. In addition to the wounds, she is covered in 1,000 angry red insect bites, some of which are infected, requiring further treatment. He also removes a long wooden splinter, unknowingly impaled in the sole of Julianne's foot. Her damaged knee would remain swollen for months. It wasn't until much later that an orthopedic surgeon found that she had ruptured her cruciate ligaments. Julianne's recovery went from strength to strength. Her collapsed stomach remembered its job, and with it returned a ravenous appetite. Julianne maintains that throughout her 11-day journey, through which she had suffered from serious injury and very little food, her body suppressed nearly all sensation of pain. It was undoubtedly this instinctive bodily response that helped allow her to function and survive her ordeal. It is not until several days later that she is reunited with her father. Her father, who has been contending with the all but certain deaths of both his wife as well as his daughter. He takes her in his arms and they hold each other tight. The overwhelming moment leaves no room for any observable emotion, much less for words. They simply hold each other in desperate relief. Julianne had survived and had found her way home. 27 years later, Julianne was contacted by a movie director, Werner Herzog. Up to this point, Julianne had done her best to avoid any contact with journalists and filmmakers, but Herzog came to her with an extraordinary proposition. As part of the film that they would eventually make, Julianne returned to the site of the plane crash with her husband, as well as Werner Herzog and the rest of his film crew. They retraced the path she had taken alone, all the way back to the site of the wreckage. Herzog even persuaded her to travel there by plane. Julianne's miraculous survival has been the subject of much speculation. When the plane was caught in that fateful thunderstorm, lightning strikes caused it to fragment into pieces. It is theorized that as Julianne fell, she benefited from an updraft that slowed her descent, while the thick forest foliage cushioned her fall. After recovering from her injuries, she travelled to Germany, where, like her parents, she studied biology before later earning her doctorate at the University of Munich. She would later return to Peru, conducting research in mammalogy. By all accounts, Julianne's psychological survival has been remarkable by any standards, very nearly matching her physical survival. Following her ordeal, she grieved for her mother and suffered from nightmares. The thought that haunted her was why she had been the one to live when so many had died. But through the sheer strength of will that brought her home to her father was also the ability to confront her great fear. Life's problems are patient and willing to wait. Perhaps there was a time when Julianne buried hers, but ultimately she had the courage to step back onto a plane, to speak of her suffering, and to return to the site where for 11 days straight death stalked by her side. It's not easy to look your greatest fear in the face, but when we take a lingering look into its eyes, empowered with the strength that Julianne required, we can rationalize any fear and overcome any obstacle. That formidable mental strength will forever be the legacy of Julianne Koepka. Thank you for listening to this second episode in Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account at Nightmares of a Doctor or via email nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.